Very good. Welcome back to the Midrash. We're continuing our learning of Tanit. We're on Daf 5B1. So we're going to go to 5B1. I want to dedicate this year in memory of Tzvi Nachum Ben Chaim Yehuda Racha Dova, little Harry, who in our community we are mourning his loss. And I want to say that tonight's Gemara, as sometimes Jewish texts really are and what they give us and what they do for us, tonight's Gemaras are really deeply, the beginning story particularly, reflections about this power of life and death that God has in his hands. The Matachot Shel HaChayim V'HaMavet. We saw that Midrash towards the beginning of the Masechta, that, you know, in God's hands are the powers of life and death. And we continue to say that, you know, only individuals for themselves sometimes can figure out if their sufferings are, like the Gemara says in Brachot, coming from heaven, and we have to figure out how we live with a God who takes from us an 11-year-old. And, you know, here in the Beit Midrash, we can ask the deeper questions, kind of, you know, as lookers into, as study students of the Gemara, what exactly are the sages offering in terms of their view of the world and how the powers of life and death really work in individual instances. And it's going to be actually through a story about the prophet Shmuel tonight that we see and sense that the rabbis, I'll just, you know, kind of give it away, I give the punchline away at the beginning because I think it's very important to understand the framing of what this story reveals, and maybe you'll have other messages that you take away from the story, and I'm interested in, to hear kind of what you take from the passage we're about to learn. But one of them is that the chess player, God the chess player, versus God the creator and the process theology that goes along with God the creator, meaning God unlocked the world in terms of its reality, its unfolding reality, and the natural law and the way the world unfolds, and even with dialogue with some very special people who can help kind of influence heaven, and heaven can be brought down to earth in different ways, and powers can be granted in very small doses to the right people, even the powers of life and death, as we saw with Elisha and Elijah, that there's a certain kind of comfort in seeing God, the one who created the world that shall unfold, and the processes of the world shall be, you know, naturally anchored in what we call law or natural law, or observation will show us that it will operate in a certain kind of way, but that God doesn't work sometimes in a chess player kind of way. Even when it seems like sometimes God is making decisions on a divine level based on a dialogue with one of the prophets, or based on a dialogue with one of the people who has some ministerial power in that midrashic way that we saw, that God has those close to God, close to the divine, close to the divine will, who sometimes can be either granted a little bit of that, a bit of that power, or who have an ear in heaven. Right? So all of that is to say that we're grappling with life and death and how it's going to unfold down here on earth, and we're grappling with it in the sense that God wants the world to be full of the kind of fertility that comes along with rains and fields that are recipients of rains in their seasons, right? And so this, again, trope of life and death that comes in the Masechta comes parallel to this natural world that we have talked about, that liturgically we are determining when the right time to start saying about the rains are, and not to finish saying when the rains are. So all that still links to. Okay? So let's jump into the passage and we'll see how that manifests. Page? I'm on 5B1. Daf Hey, Amud Bet. And it's towards the beginning of the Daf. If you're in the Tzurat HaDaf of the Vilna, it's find V'amar Le Rav Nachman Le Rav Yitzchak. Remember that we're in the Rav Nachman, Rav Yitzchak Rav Yochanan set of teachings. Right? And it seems to be, I'll just mention again, it seems to be an anthology of some sort when it comes to what the Gemara is including on these pages, because all these various learnings that we've done in this section are really about Rav Nachman, who's posing either questions to Rav Yitzchak or bringing up what Rav Yochanan says and getting clarifications. Okay. Ba'amar le Rav Nachman le Rav Yitzchak. Rav Nachman says to Rav Yitzchak, my dichtiv vayehi ka'asher zaken Shmuel. What is the meaning of that which is written, and it came to pass when Shmuel was old? Now, Shmuel, if we remember, is the prophet of the era of King David. Shmuel is the prophet in the era of, before King David, King Saul. Shmuel is the one who was involved in appointing the king, the first king of Israel, who is King Saul. Despite the fact that it didn't sound like such a good idea to have a king, like everybody else, God and Shmuel ultimately came up with the plan to appoint a king. And that king was Saul, right? The first king of Israel. Umi siv Shmuel kulei hai. Did Shmuel ever really become so old? Right? Don't we have a tradition? Don't we know from the text that Shmuel is really not that old? V'ha bar nun bet hava, bar chamishim v'shtayim hava. He was only 52 years old when he died. You know, a young man for all intents and purposes in our eyes. De'amar mar, as the master taught in Abraita, met b'chamishim v'shtayim shana. He died at the age of 52 years. Zehu mitato shel Shmuel haramati. That is the death of Shmuel the Rahamite. Amar le, Rabbi Yitzchak answered him, because Rabbi Yitzchak is right speaking to Rabbi Nachman. Hachi amar Rabbi Yochanan. Now we get another Rabbi Yochanan's tradition here. Zikna kafzalav. Old age came upon Shmuel very suddenly. Right? In general, what that means, you see the parenthetical remark there, his hair turned white prematurely. Yeah? He had signs of aging. Now, what do we do with a statement that someone had premature aging at age 52 in terms of it being a brita? Number one, I think we all have been witness in our time to presidents who have taken on obligations in the office and then 4 years later, their hair is white, right? It really, stress in life and stress in leadership can create for some physical manifestations. And in some of the extra literary kind of stuff that you read about this sugya, and a sugya over in Brachot where Elazar ben Azaria was supposed to take over the leadership of the sages in the central Beit Midrash, and he was taking upon the leadership role, and the Gemara looks and they say, wait a minute, you look like such a youngster. How could you possibly do this job, right? And it says, oh, yeah, that day 18 rows of gray hair appeared in his head suddenly. Probably what it meant was that at a very stressful time among the sages, that he had assumed a little bit more leadership without being the leader appointed that day. Like, what was going on in the background, right? He had assumed a little bit more stress in his life to really take on leadership roles. And a person can look harried. A person can show signs of some physical aging in those moments, right? So that's one possibility here, is that premature aging. What do we know about Shmuel? With what we just said before, it's a very stressful time. He was very stressed about Am Yisrael wanting a king in the theater of the ancient peoples with whom the Israelites had relationships. No, make us a king. We need protection, and we need organization, and we need to feel unified. So he goes and he's arguing with God, who he thinks is, you know, not really supportive of all this. And God ultimately winds up telling him, no, do what the people say. And he, you know, he has some regrets about doing that. And Shaul, the first king, Saul, doesn't really live up to everybody's big plan for a king, right? And that's part of the reality here, too, that he's just disappointed with all that he's trying to get done in life. Shmuel thought, maybe I could be the one to make the difference now if I had the divine permission to do this, and I appointed the king, and the Jewish people and Israel, ancient Israel, needs a king because that's what God agrees to. Maybe I have a bigger role and task in actually seeing to it that he succeeds. And so some of the stress when we read Sefer Shmuel inside too, we can see the Shmuel Aleph and Shmuel Bet, right? That's the part of the Tanakh we're talking about here. We see that he's really struggling. It's really a spiritual, psychological endeavor to try to get this on track when the people are so misguided. And we're talking about the people. We're talking about, a lot of times, having insight into the very, very kind of tensions of political administration that's so misguided in so many ways when you talk about Saul. So, by the way, if you haven't read those books lately, what great books to read, you know. So, just to put that out there. So, anyhow, it happened to him. We have a brisa, we have a tradition that he really did die young at 52. Rabbi Yochanan gives the reason for Shmuel's premature aging. He's going to explore that now, from his own point of view. Dichtiv, it's written, I'm on the second column of 5b1 now, the right-hand column. Nichamti ki himlachti et Shaul. I regret having made Shaul the king. Amar lefanav, Shmuel says before God, Ribono shel olam, Master of the universe, Shekalatani kamo shev Aaron, you equated me with Moses and Aaron. God, I felt majorly responsible for this people. No, I didn't have to lead them out of Egypt, but I did have to lead them through this time of the melucha, of the first appointment of a king. This was really serious, God. Dichtiv. And how do we know that Shmuel was made to be on the same level or weighed equivalently with Moses and with Aaron? Because there's a verse that's written, Moshe v'Aharon v'Chohenav u'Shmuel b'Korei Shemo. Those who come to Friday nights, right? We know this because we hear this. And there's a special tune for this part of the Kabbalat Shabbat service. We sing, Moshe v'Aaron b'Chohanav u'Shmuel b'Korei Shemo. Right? And we kind of even emphasize Shmuel. There's a certain part of us that, wow, we can't believe it. Well, guess what? Shmuel himself here is saying in the Gemara, wow, I had a towering responsibility. You put me on this level of Moses and Aaron. And he says, Ma Moshe v'Aharon lo batlu ma'aseh yideihem b'chayehem. Therefore, just as the handiwork of Moses and Aaron did not come to naught in their lifetime, Af ani lo yitbatel ma'aseh yadai b'chayai, the same should apply to me. My handiwork should not come to naught in my lifetime. I see the whole kingdom here is unraveling. Now this, to me, is really about an intense conversation with the Kodesh Baruch Hu, with God, at the end of his life. That somehow he feels he knows his life is ending. I was speaking about this passage. I said, Amy, you have to listen to this. And this is really, to me, it sounds like a very deep conversation as someone is recognizing that his imminent time is coming. And, you know, like, please let me have worked in my life to really have accomplished what task you gave me, God. And it's so deeply reflective and so searching for meaning and so searching for that kind of divine stamp of approval. And Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and then God says in return, Heichi Avid, what shall I do? Lemut Shaul? He takes it to this level. Are you, let Saul die immediately? Meaning, yeah. Are you asking for the appointment of who? Who's coming after Saul? David. Are you saying, like, let there be a new king right now so you can see it in your lifetime? Lo kashavik Shmuel. Samuel would not allow that. He heard that God answered like this, and he says, wait a minute, I'm not suggesting, no, you're not suggesting that Shaul is going to get it now. I'm not suggesting that Shaul get it now so that David can be appointed, so that we all know that this goes in the right direction. That's not what I'm saying. From the human side, God, I'm not saying you need, I mean, I'm, yes, praying that, not, my question really was, will you let me see my work really come to fruition in my lifetime? But no, I'm not really asking you, will you make sure that that happens by making sure Shaul's out of the picture and King David should ascend to the throne now? No, God, I'm not asking you that. Lo ka shavik Shmuel. Shmuel would not allow it. Now, what's interesting here is that just internally to what we've learned, and because we're learning page by page, we can see this. What did Shmuel just do by saying this? He said, if I had the key to life and death in my hand, that's not how I would do it. Lemut Shmuel arzutar. Let Shmuel die young. Miranene abatre. And then the people would malign Shmuel, claiming that he died at a relatively young age on account of some wrongdoing he committed. Because remember, at this time, they are kind of putting death, and early death particularly, alongside as a sign of someone's wrongdoing, right?
Is this God who was saying this, or Shmuel? I don't
know. This is God.
People within the line, Samuel. God saying.
This is God. Is God saying? Am I really going to do that? You know, can I do that? Can I let Samuel die young? People would malign Samuel. So, lo lemut Shaul, v'lo lemut Shmuel. Let neither Saul or Samuel die. That too is unacceptable. God is now weighing the situation. God is, with the power of life and death in his own hands, figuring out, like, how am I going to take care of what I need to take care of here? Kvar higia malchut David, for the designated time of the reign of David has come. V'ein malchut no ga'at. And one reign may not encroach upon another reign, even by a hairbreadth. I can't have two kings at once. This is not the time for two kings. This is not the northern and the southern kingdoms. This is a time of unity. So there's behind that, right? We know what's going to unfold. There's going to be a breakdown of the unity of the kingdom. There's going to be a northern and a southern kingdom where some kings will serve at the same time as other kings. Now is not the time for that. Amar Kodesh Baruch Hu, the Holy One, blessed be He, said in conclusion, Ach Pitzalav Zikna, I will make Samuel age prematurely. In that way, Shmuel will predecease Shaul, and Shmuel, because he's aged early, will not be suspect like he would have been as a young man, should he have died then, without this Ziknut. Without this old age coming upon him. People can understand dying of the stress and of the physical challenge that stress comes along with, even back at that time. This is what I take from the Midrash. That there are certain times that so stressed could a person be that the health is compromised, that whatever it means, like physically not taken care or that there is an extra amount of stress in an already genetically susceptible human being, that they should weaken under the absolute kind of tensions that come along with such national responsibility and such unbelievable divine kind of mission to do in life. So this was the answer at this point. I'm sorry, what did you have to offer as well?
There is another interesting possibility.
Yeah, what's that?
We now recognize a syndrome of bone marrow failure related to defects in telomeres. And that's actually associated with premature gray hair. So it may well be that...
An early death?
Yeah. And so it may well be that this is the first description of that syndrome. So I just offered that up.
Yeah.
For those who are not particularly committed to the stress hypothesis.
They didn't study the molecular biology.
And I don't know what the longevity is of people who've been presidents or, you know, but I'm not sure it's terribly shorter than the general population.
Well, I would say, I just looked at that this week.
Uh-huh.
As a matter of fact, it's increased. But
yeah.
The reason why it's increased
is
because they're really well taken care of.
Right, but then you can't have it both ways.
No, but I'm not talking about modernity.
Yeah, well, I'm just saying.
I'm not talking about modernity.
I'm not even sure back then the leaders were necessarily short-lived relative to everything.
Oh, I think so. I think that, you had a larger chance. Here's the way I would answer that. You had a bigger chance of being assassinated. Two, you were constantly under threat of your life and living with significant fear of physical violence being thrust against you. And C, when it came to Shmuel, the kind of tension that's within the narratives themselves, I think, truly reveal carrying the weight of the people in such a way that's completely entirely nothing. Who has very shortened lifespans based on some work that the literature likes to talk about, and you would probably have more insight as to some of these theories than I would. People who take on responsibilities for small children, they say that heads of school and private school institutions oftentimes have more stress, higher blood pressure, certain health kinds of things to watch out for. Now, when I was in that field, that was a serious notion of what self-care was about.
I don't know any of this.
And there are certain professions where if people are called upon to be more responsible, especially for more patients in poorer areas, the number of nurses that have stress is really incredible. Lee Shulman at Stanford at the Rockefeller, I think it's Rockefeller out there too, at the Rockefeller Institute for Education, studies medical education, by the way, and is, by the way, a Ramah guy in our camp, and talked about these things. At least it was more than a decade ago that I was listening to him speak. So I guess that's one of the reasons why my strong read here was of such. The fact that someone could have a syndrome that we might see, that we know about now, is not impossible. But the fact that there's also the trope in Brachot that I mentioned of this guy who needed to become a leader and then got gray hair immediately, I think they are really tapping into the kind of stress that happens in mega moments of leadership transitions and potentials and what needs to happen in order to keep this people afloat.
Look at the graying of Barack Obama during his presidency.
That was one of the kinds of things that I think we could point to very much. I think Clinton, by the way, had it too.
Yeah, I think he did.
He must have heart disease.
And if he didn't have the kind of docs that he had, or have, there was just an article about it in the Wall Street Journal, by the way, about the longevity of presidents. So that's one another of the places that I just saw this.
What was the syndrome again? I didn't hear what you said.
It's telomeres. Telomerase is an enzyme that keeps the ends of your chromosomes from getting too short.
Very interesting. On the larger level now, back to God's decision-making, what we're getting some insight to from the rabbi's perspective is this shikul that God is making, this back and forth that God is, this decision-making. And he's obviously in dialogue with Shmuel, according to this midrash. But listen to the way it now unfolds. Hainu dichtiv, in reference to this, it is written, V'Shaul Yoshev b'Giv'ah tachat ha'eshel b'Ramah. Shaul was sitting in Giv'ah under the tree in Ramah. V'chima inyan Giv'ah etzel Ramah. And now what is the relevance of Giv'ah, which is in Benjamin's territory, to Ramah, which is in the mountains of Ephraim? Ela lomar lach, it must be that the verse comes to say, Mi garam l'Shaul sheyeshev b'Giv'ah shtei shanim u'mechitza. Who brought it about that Shaul, a Benjaminite, dwelled in Giv'ah for 2.5 years? Tefilato shel Shmuel haramati. It was really the prayer of Shmuel. So he said, no, I'm not talking about upending the life of this guy. God says, well, what am I supposed to do? And then figures out exactly the case here about how it's going to unfold. The Gemara then asks, Umi midichi gavra mikame gavra? Does one man get pushed aside for the sake of another? Would God have brought about Shmuel's death? In other words, that he did so prematurely with his aging and then had him, you know, be recognized in history as someone who didn't necessarily fail but did his best for Am Yisrael. Then Shaul would die, and then this next guy would come underneath Shaul or in place of Shaul. Is that what God does? Does he kind of plan out the unfolding reality of history when it comes to succession of kings and the death of prophets? In other words, in the larger sense, is God up there really calculating the 1, 2, 3 of deaths in the world like that? And extending one person's life and bringing on old age first and by this one so that no one says anything? And the Gemara answers, Ain. No, that's a yes in this case. Ain. Not Ain no ose, but in the Aramaic. Ain, as in Cain. Ain. The Amar Rabbi Shmuel Bar Nachmani Amar Rabbi My Dichtiv Al Kain Chatzavti B'Nevi'im Haragtim B'Imrefi. What is the meaning of that which is written? Therefore I have hewn out my word by the prophets, I have killed them with the words of my mouth. B'Maaseihem Lo Ne'emar. It does not say that they were killed as a result of their deeds on account of some wrongdoing. Ela B'Imrefi. Rather, with the words of my mouth. Alma midichi gavra mikame gavra. Thus, we see that one man can be pushed aside for another man. Ah, but now the Gemara, I think, made a little bit of a redemption for God, in essence, not being a chess player. Even though it sounds a little like that still. Here's the redemption. It has nothing to do with one's deeds. It's not like God saw you move this way, you move that way, and then God did this and that. It's that God's words, in general, do create the design for the world, our history, life and death, and what seems on the human plane as one goes, so another comes. But one does not need to think of those individuals being 100% absolutely judged by God for what they did or did not accomplish. This wasn't an answer to Shmuel's longing prayer, meaning-making moment. God, did I or did I not succeed in this life? Tell me. Because your decision, I know, is going to be based on this final judgment. No, that's not what unfolds here. Which could have been the way God said, well, here's what you did or didn't do, and therefore I will finalize your days, and your death will make way for Shaul to die, or Shaul's death will make way for you to die based on what happened, based on the actual deeds that you performed. That's the Gemara in the end saying, now there is an Imre Fi of God. There are spoken words of God who is the narrator, the creator of reality, life, death as we know, and it seems to us on our plane that there's one that comes after the next and one gives way to the next, and that's even a little bit distressing based on some of the distress we feel in the midrash that led up to this conversation between God and Shmuel. But rest assured, it is the Imre Fi, and it's God's word that created this, and that's the way that people, one is kind of taken and place and potential is created for the next one to come. And where am I making that strong read, or how am I getting to that strong read that I feel there's some redemption in the way this little passage ends? Because Imre Fi, you know, that's ultimately God's responsibility for what God has said. And Imre Fi also reminds me of the power of God as creator, and not necessarily Dayan HaEmet. Because I think that it could have very well taken the tack of God is the true judge, and God will be the one to judge, and it will be about the deeds, and therefore, you know, it will be God's plans that are ultimately the plans. And Shmuel has no right to say me first, or you first, or him first, or them first. But that there's a gentleness to the Imre Fi that comes along at the end of this Midrashic passage, which speaks to me more of the way of the world versus the judgment for deeds.
I find it very...
Dale?
I'm not sure if I understood all of this, but it seems to me that what you're calling gentleness is that we cannot judge others' deaths as punishment, but it leaves us with an arbitrariness from our perspective. Is that right?
I do think that that's exactly it. And I don't know what you feel like you don't really understand in this, so we can go back and look. Because I think it's a little less, it's not exactly clear what the pshat is, if that's what you're searching for. We don't have a, you know, kind of a nice bow on the story. But I do think that arbitrariness, if you will, is as arbitrary as the rains in their seasons. In other words, we expect rains to come in their seasons, and we can generally count on it, and we add the tefillot that, you know, here comes the rains, and we can bless God for the power, right? Well, we know human affairs aren't so seasonal in that regard. Shmuel, who's struggling with making some meaning of his spiritual and political activity in his life, says, you equated me with Moses and Aaron. Will you let me see this in my lifetime, God? Will you make me know that my work had meaning? God kind of says, well, how should I do that? Should I take you before Shaul? Or should I take Shaul before you? Is that what you're saying here? I'm not trying to help you manage exactly what goes on here with people, God. I know that's Imre Ficha. I know that's your words, is what ultimately comes out at the end for me. What Shmuel's saying is that just don't let me die with the disrespect and the disrespect of my people and my being suspect of not having succeeded in a plan that you made.
So after this back and forth between God and Shmuel, where God is essentially saying there's nothing I can do,
he did do something. What did he do?
But he leaves it with Shmuel as if, what do you want from me? There's nothing I can do. And then if God does do something, he kills Shmuel before Shaul and protects his reputation. Am I reading that correctly?
Right. You are. And in a certain sense, what Shmuel is really asking for, it's not that he asks God for it and God grants it to him, though it kind of feels like that if you want to make it a quid pro quo kind of give and take. What he's, I think, saying by way of his own tefillot is, let me come to some peace with this, as he's stressed, as he's prematurely aging, and goes before Shaul, and can have a sense, though, that he was the one, a partner with God, putting the people on the right track.
I'm just the central criterion of success of Moses and Aaron is defined as the fact that their disciple Joshua died after them. That seems to me a very strange criterion, and that seems to be the major issue here. And so I don't know what that's supposed to say in terms of the criterion of a prophet. So that part I just would love to understand in more depth. Because I would think that there are a lot other criteria that you would want to use to define your success as a prophet.
Yeah. I think in terms of, Barry's making reference to the fact that the Art Scroll translation puts in an idiomatic addition which is on footnote number 8, which is in the lighter type on the right-hand side of the column on 5b1, which says, just as the handiwork of Moses and Aaron did not come to naught in their lifetimes, inasmuch as their disciple Joshua survived them, the same should apply to me. Okay? Now, I purposefully did not rest my hat on understanding the Midrash on that take. What we see in the Rashi, Masayidehen, Rashi does say, Yehoshua afhu hayat talmido shel Aharon. The reason why Rashi adds anything about Joshua in that case is because the question is, wait a minute, I thought Joshua was a student of Moshe. Are you saying he's also a student of Aaron? And so Rashi comes along and says, no, don't worry about it, don't worry. He did learn from Aaron too. He knew how to teach everything Moshe needed him to teach, and he knew how to teach everything that Aaron needed him to teach, okay? But the comment before, when he says, Ushmuel b'korei shemo, he kind of makes a comment on Moshe Aharon, and then Shmuel, he just says Shavinen. He just says, they're equal. Now, I'm not feeling as though the Midrash needs to be interpreted with his ask of God to make him equal, like he should have a disciple. Though some point to the fact that he's looking to make sure that David becomes the right king after Shaul, right? And that he really wants to see that. So you could go that direction, that he wants the equivalent. I think there's a much deeper sense of longing for his, as Dale used the word, reputation, for his entire reputation to be preserved, and his hard work, because the first question was, how come he had such old age, kofetzalav? How come he had such stress, and how come he had such decline so rapidly as a young man? And so the larger question about life and its potentials and life and its stresses opened up the whole limud when Rav Nachman brought the question to Rav Yitzchak to begin with. So I wasn't going leprat to that kind of narrow read of the Midrash. I was going to a more expansive read of the Midrash. But you could say very much that there's a narrower read of the Midrash.
I'm sorry. To me, it's the quality of the person you selected.
Right. Who selected the person? God selected Joseph, right?
Right. Well, so
so it's God's responsibility. Why even take responsibility on the issue? He was the one who established the kingdom as a system.
It's a good answer.
Because of the people.
I mean, that was going to be my next.
Right. So I mean, this is the path.
Yeah. For those who don't remember, it's Shaul, Saul, who became the first king, really was not necessarily a Shmuel choice.
It's hard to see it anything other than punishment. If you want to reward him, he would have the perspective of living through the transition. vision of Saul to David.
Or it could be a blessing to die before the guy goes off the rails.
I would just say that that's, I would just say that, and then I'll get to the... Listen, I'll get to you in a second. Bobby, I think that that's why there's such a question here. He's trying to really make peace with the fact that he's now seen his own early demise. And so, no, we're not saying there's a reward in that, and we're not saying that it's total reward based on that. But it is a kind of a making peace, and it could be seen as he wanted to have his reputation protected, and therefore there's this kind of working together with God on a divine level to protect that. But what I'm sensing in the passage is that he just is trying to figure out how he can be at peace, knowing that this didn't all work out exactly, and that his efforts needed to be recognized, and he shouldn't be maligned at his death. Meira.
First of all, the story of Shmuel and Shaul is two tragedies colliding. Two tragedies.
Mm-hmm.
Tragedy of Shmuel, who is older, is that at the age of 3 years old, he is separated from his mother.
Right.
And from that point on, he grows like the Dalai Lama, you know, with these old men. And he has no real family life. He has no real emotional life. He just becomes, grows into this role. And he's hardened. The way I see a hardened person, very hard inside. Mm. And he does a job. And then people come to him and say, okay, we want a king. And for him, it's like an end of an era.
Mm.
And he wants to preserve the old era. At least he does his job. He wants to preserve what was, the confederacy, the tribes, the whole system. But then he feels like he cannot stand against these the pressure from the people. He wants a king. And then it gets the better of him, the way I say it. And that's what I said earlier. It's like a spite thing. Okay, you want a king? I'll give you a weakling. I'll give you someone who's a little bit soft in the head, who has these visions and so on. And he doesn't even think about it. He just does it. And then he sits back and takes account on that. And he says, what have I done? I was giving in to my own ego, maybe, or my own desires, and I wasn't really following the greater need of history or something. So that's the tragedy of Shmuel. He had a tragic life. With Shaul was also tragic, and so when Shmuel dies, the story goes on, and there's more tragedy related to Shaul. So maybe God spared him. Okay, you've seen enough. Okay, now let history unfold, and we'll fix it later. So it's one of the biggest stories in the Bible that I like. I see it like a movie. You can make a movie of it.
Mm-hmm.
The personalities, the unfolding. It's a huge drama and tragedy. So I see.
Yeah. That's good. Good to capture in some of the tragedy and drama, and I think he's really struggling at the end of his life. Definitely. Okay. Let's push on with some more text. All right. 5b2 on the left-hand side. We're going to have now another teaching from Rabbi Yochanan, which Rabbi Yitzchak reports to Rabbi Nachman. And very, very timely here. It's going to be very timely because sometimes you're in a text and you're learning Talmud. And what's the timeliness here? That it's going to talk about our story that we're reading in the Parshiot that we're reading in the Torah. So we're going to get some insight into Pasuk from our story. And we're going to have this is going to be set. Talk about movies and films. Like, think about a meal, and they're sitting at a meal together. And again, just to point out, okay, fine. One possibility of why we get all these Rabbi Nachman and Rabbi Yitzchak and Rabbi Yochanan stories is because they've anthologized these stories in one place in the Gemara, and it makes sense because they're talking about these guys together and getting Rabbi Yochanan lessons, clarifying things through Rabbi Yochanan's lessons, that we have this all together. Okay, that is one possibility. Another possibility is that they have a couple of these that really pertain very much to our sugya that we started already, pages 2, 3, and 4, and some of the elements within Tani, and that they're very important for us by way of themes that come out. And I point this out because I think there's a theme in this next story. There are actually two themes in this next story that work with some of the kind of discussions that have been going on about fertility and that being the hope with the rains in their right seasons, and how relationships between God and the Jewish people, Torah from heaven and Jewish people down below, that is real love and connectedness, and other types of love need to be put into check because that's the real love. You know, the bride and the groom here, the reference is the heavens and the earth, the rain and the soil, the teachings of the Torah from heaven and the Jewish people down below. And also, remember we made mention that, or I made mention of the fact that I saw in one of the pages a very deep read against certain Greek ideas about the divinity, pantheon of gods, mythology, and the notion of some duality. It was a unification of God's reign, both a double entendre, God's reign and God's reign, and that there is a way of seeing some anti-Greek polemic within the pages of Gemara, as much as we see any other anti-cultural swirling, realities of cultures swirling in this era of the rabbis. Sometimes we see polemics against them in the Gemara. Here we're going to see one that's anti-Greek, and we're also going to catch one, because we're talking about Jewish liturgy, and we're talking about the way Jews recognize divine power, and how divinity manifests in the world, we're even going to catch some anti-Christian polemic in this next passage that happens with Rabbi Yochanan's teachings, Rabbi Yitzchak and Rabbi Nachman. So all that, to hit some drums that we've already kind of hit on pages 2, 3, and 4 in the Masechta, and some interesting material to come, that seems like, wait a minute, this is coming out of like left field. Why are they including this discussion about this verse and this mention of this text about a prostitute and all this? And so we're going to make some sense of it by way of understanding the greater context that it comes in. All right, here we go. Rabbi Nachman and Rabbi Yitzchak havu yatve besudat. Rabbi Nachman and Rabbi Yitzchak were sitting at a meal. Immediately, if I have rabbinic ears and I hear sitting at a meal, what could I be thinking about?
Seder.
What they're eating.
Shabbat.
Maybe Shabbat.
I think it was a business meal.
Maybe they live near each other?
Maybe they were doing blessings. Rabbi Yitzchak, by the way, is someone who came to Bavel. He was Eretz Yisraeli. Good question. Keep that in mind. So, all right, they're at a meal. You could be thinking about blessings. You could be thinking about all kinds of things. And if you know Pirkei Avot, a suda, a meal, is a time to what? To share words of Torah. Because no meal is a meal in our tradition if you don't have a little bit of Torah. Okay, so that's some of the background. As soon as I hear the word sudata, you know, the ears prick up. And we say, okay, lots of potential discussions could unfold here. Amar le Rav Nachman le Rav Yitzchak. Rav Nachman says to Rav Yitzchak, Lema mar milta. So let the master come over here and share a word of Torah. You know, it's kind of like when, I don't know if this is part of a cultural piece of Judaism that you've experienced, but if you're sitting at a Shabbat table, or you're sitting at an event or an affair, and someone at the table turns to you and say, who has a Devar Torah? You know, you should have a Devar Torah. So a person should have a Devar Torah ready. Let the master teach some Torah. Amar le. Rabbi Yitzchak answers him. Hachi amar Rabbi Yochanan. I have a Rabbi Yochanan teaching for you. Ein masichin besuda. You shouldn't talk during a meal. What do you mean you shouldn't talk during a meal? Immediately, like it.
How can you do
What? Right, exactly. We have a tradition of talking during meals. We have a tradition of talking Torah during meals. So we're immediately in surprise mode here. Without any of the Tosfos saying, Tema, surprise, shock. Well, we are surprised to hear such a thing coming from a Jewish mouth. Shema yakdim kane leveshet. Here's why you don't say anything. Lest one's windpipe precede the esophagus in receiving the food. V'yavo lide sakana. And therefore, you really endanger your friend. Ah, so, all right. So let's try to figure out what's being said just in that little piece so far. Because we know we have a tradition that says, kasher shnayim yoshvim b'shulcha. When two sit at a table, divrei Torah should be exchanged. Why? What are you hoping to accomplish by exchanging divrei Torah? The Shekhinah, God's indwelling presence, should rest upon you. Now, that's a very, very compelling idea. And something that we absolutely know. And by the way, don't we make meals and encourage people to say divrei Torah around tables with food sitting there? What's that?
But not with your mouth full.
Ah, but not with your mouth full. But not with your mouth full. So it turns out, if you look at the big, thick Gemara here, where they're bringing you everybody's reactions, who they could find throughout history, he says, HaMefarshim heiru al mashe rabo to maase. The Mefarshim were really perplexed by all of what was being said here, just in this little piece alone. First of all, does he not know the halakha that you shouldn't speak vis-a-vis, having your mouth full? Of course he knows that. Rabbi Yitzchak sheheshiv lo ein mesichin harei b'dibur ze'atmo mesiachu b'suda. By saying the Devar Torah, sharing the halakha, that we have a halakha that you don't actually say such conversation or share Devar Torah at the meal. He's actually studying a Devar Torah. This is a problem. Halo b'dibor ze she'amar ein mesichin b'suda shema yakdim kane leveshet v'yavo lidei sachana. By sharing that Devar Torah that it comes to danger and your windpipe could be before your esophagus, yesh yoter tevot me'adibor she'amar lo achar suda. And by the way, if you want to look at what Torah is to come in the sugi, if we already read, we know that he's going to say a Devar Torah on a verse with three words. Like, this one has more words than that one. So they're really, like, building up the case that this is really strange. Okay? V'chol ze davka b'toch ha-suda. Ah, but maybe what he means is this, that during the actual eating of the food, we have to be very careful. Aval bein tavshil l'tavshil. But between courses, what's a Jew to do? Mesichin. Talk and offer divrei Torah. Ein chashash l'sochech. There's no fear that you could then have conversation. Fa'ad rabba mitzvahi l'lamod Torah al shulchano. And quite frankly, quite the oppositely, it's a mitzvah to learn Torah while you're at a table with food. So, by the way, what's that whole area about? And this I'll bring another time to show you some of the articles all about this. There were certain traditions in the ancient world where they said, not kosher to speak divine words while you've got food on the table. You want to be very careful to have a meal, finish it, and then have sacred words.
Are you saying that's a Jewish?
No, I'm saying that's not a Jewish
not
ideal.
A Jewish point of view.
That a Jewish point of view, that they were so forward-thinking about devising halakha that said, during your meal, and here refining that, between courses we mean, because we realize that if we're going to command people to speak and to share Divrei Torah, we don't want them to do it with their mouth full.
That Christian to not have divine things during a meal?
Well, to go into that history a little bit, there were those who believed that the kind of rabbinic teachings regarding sharing Divrei Torah and holy words were antithetical to certain early Christian groups.
Mm-hmm.
there were groups. There were groups who also, on a more monastic level, you just took the word out of my mouth, ate in silence.
Right.
And then there were certain groups who, more in the Gnostic kind of mode, mystical mode, unlocked the potential of food without words, and would only sing at their meals. So there's early studies of what tables are like and food culture is like around religious circles is some work of scholars in the early rabbinic period into the early Christian period and into the early even medieval period. Okay, that's for another time. I'm just reading a great book about it called The Lord's Table, which I will share with you a little bit more about when we get to some other places where we talk about some eating and some fasting, because eating and fasting will become part and parcel of Tanit and what we study within the Masechet. Okay, Shlosha she'achlu, but let's quote what we know from Pirkei Avot. Shlosha she'achlu al shulchan v'lo amru alav divrei Torah. Three people who eat at a table and don't share words of Torah. Nechshav ki'ilu achlu mizbechei meiti. They are thought of as eating from the altar of the dead, worshiping the dead. Now, I'm putting that right now without sharing again the extensive scholarship in this greater context of a suda is an important place for words of Torah, and there are people who in our tradition today take this so seriously. I think I've told you that I lived my first year in Jerusalem with Reb Benyamin Zevoloni and his wife Bruria, and they had 9 children, and they lived in Machne Yehuda, and they're, you know, very much involved with he's Iraqi and she's Moroccan, and they are students of Rav Avadi Yosef, extremely, extremely Haredi. Haredi is not enough. It's extremely Haredi, and their words to me about the table were, bo lechol, come to eat, kshesh lecha davar Torah, when you have a davar Torah. Anachnu yoshvim levarech velo lechol. We sit down to bless, not to eat. You know, and they were really serious about it. So every time you were at the table, lomar mar, have you a word? Have you something to offer here? Was a very serious value in their house, to the point where the balabait, the rav of the house, fasted from words other than Torah and other than verses of Psalms for most Sabbaths that I spent in their home. Just as a limitation. Now, that seems to be a little more ascetic than the kind of human factor of setting out the hope that we would share words of Torah within and among others at meal times. And so I finally broke the ice and talked to him a little bit about it and said, like, you know, it seems to me that the Mishnah really said it's within the experience of Sudav with that sense of v'achalta v'savata uveirachta. Like you told me, we sit down to bless, but there's the savata part. There's and you shall be satisfied, right? And satisfaction comes not only from tasting good food, but from this socializing and making, you know, an interesting kind of meal happen and being together. We had this ongoing conversation. But this was a real conversation. Again, I share this because here we know from Pirkei Avot that we're supposed to really live this out. And here they are at the meal, and they're worried. And I think the most logical part of the whole exploration is that you shouldn't talk with your mouth full. Or, there's one other sage who said, it's not a matter of you talking with your mouth full. It's a matter of you should be very careful. This is like a nice Musar piece. It's a nice ethical kind of piece. You should be careful to share your Torah when you are sure that your friend over there is not going to choke on whatever he's eating. Right? So that, like, let's say that you have a Devar Torah, and it's about an issue you care passionately about. And it's not exactly your friend's politics. Or it's not exactly the way that, you know, your chaver, your friend, sees the world. Be very careful, because as soon as, you know, he'll gasp for air, or cough, or have to, you know, that someone's windpipe will open wide, and it will cause quite a stir at the table. Right? The Steinsaltz, some of you have the version, has this nice little anatomical diagram of the windpipe and the esophagus. And, I mean, there's been an instance or two in my life where, you know, the windpipe unfortunately precedes the esophagus from receiving whatever it is I'm either eating or trying to. And it's, sometimes it happens when, you know, you kind of take that breath through your nose and you're eating something as well, and all of a sudden, or it just kind of scratches at the top of the windpipe, so that you then go into that feeling like, what is that feeling described as? Maybe there's a word for it, but I don't know it. But that you've got to finish the coughing fit so that you can get back to normative eating. But they were very cognizant of the fact that you could potentially cause some danger to your friend if you say the wrong thing at the wrong time during a meal. So that's basically what it comes out to mean. Be careful. Now, Batar de Sa'ud, they waited until after they finished eating, according to this story. So after the meal, Amarle, Rabbi Yitzchak says to Rav Nachman, Hachi Amar Rabbi Yochanan. Here's our Rabbi Yochanan story. Here's our link to these parshiot of this week, of these last weeks, from Genesis. Said Rabbi Yochanan, Yaakov Avinu lo mate. Our father Jacob did not die. Okay. Amarle, Rabbi Nachman de Rabbi Yitzchak, v'chibichadi saftu saftanaya, v'chantu chanitaya, v'kavru kabraya. But did we not read in Genesis chapter 50, verses, you know, 2 and 10 and 13?
Joseph takes his
bones. Right. Well, even before that, that they eulogized him, and they embalmed him, and they bury him. So let's just look quickly. Genesis chapter 50, verse 2 says, Vaitzav Yosef et Avadav et Harofim lachanod et Aviv, ordered the physicians in his service to embalm his father, Vayachantu Harofim et Yisrael. And the physicians embalm Israel. Ah, but one of the medieval Mefarshim says the following. Ah, but maybe we're misunderstanding what they did. Maybe the physicians set him up into a stasis. They got him stabilized. And they were able, according to Peshat, lo mate, he's not dead, in this Devar Torah. So maybe what he meant, they got into a stable position, so that when they took his body to Eretz Yisrael, it was wrapped in bandages. One could be, in a certain sense, mummified in that way. They could have wrapped him up. Looking at verses 10 and 13, verse 10, it says, they observed a mourning period of 7 days for his father, though. And so, like, but maybe, like, that was after they finally got him to Eretz Yisrael, and then they kind of, like, backtracked a little bit, so they did bring him into the land because that was a mitzvah to do, because it said that in one of the parshiot before this that Joseph would bring him up and close his eyes, right? So this medieval parshan says, oh, I've got to figure out how Joseph really does the mitzvah of getting his father back to Israel while he's still alive, and then figure out how to still read verses 10 and 13, which is a verse about mourning him, and also verse 13, which says, his son carried him to the land of Canaan and buried him in the cave of the field of Machpelah, a field near Mamre, which Abraham had bought for the burial site. Right. So, and then they bring him over there, and they actually put his body in. So by the way, Goren HaAtad, which is beyond the Yardane, is theoretically in the land of Israel itself, says somebody else, just to point out. Oh, so it's all in the greater Israel. So he did bring that body. But you have to then deal with verse 2 as being your only problem, which again, he said, maybe just stabilize them in a certain way. The Rofim, the doctors, stabilize them as doctors can. And he was really carried there. So if you want to understand the complete pshat of he didn't die, that is the one way to figure it out. That he really didn't die physically all the way. He was just put into a kind of a moment of being suspended animation. So
it was cryogenics.
What's the connection with what we just read?
No. So don't worry about that yet.
Okay.
There is really no connection with what we just read thus far.
Other than,
if you want to go the larger theme here, and that is, we're talking about the powers of life and death, and who has any ability to influence them, and who's given a little, key on the ring, who's got the small key, who's got the big key.
No, it was the introduction to the truth.
So the Suda, I'm foreshadowing here. Thank you. I'll introduce the answer to that question now, but we won't get to that answer until after we see the whole run through. The Suda is a format that the rabbis are taking seriously. As I was reading from you from here, they are defining what's a Jewish meal look like, right? But we have to remember that a Jewish meal also reminded us of a Seder. And we also have to remember, a la Rabbi Boxer, who wrote the book, The History of the Haggadah, that Jewish seders and Jewish meals and having a scene with rabbis at meals should remind us that the rabbis are culturally creating what looks like a Jewish meal, because we're talking about the sages now, and these are paradigmatic meals, right? So they are creating what looks like a Jewish forum, a Jewish, what we consider to be a symposium of our own to share deep philosophical ideas about the material we're debating and bringing forward some of the same kinds of material that they might do over there in the Greek, what I've called Beit Pilosof. Remember, we use that term because it was mentioned in chapter 16 of Shabbat. I go back there often. And we know that there's this competing notion of creating meals and deep ideas about life and death, about philosophy, about understandings of sacred texts or texts that are central to our mission, and also have a certain format. And over here, the Suda might be the hint that there is this underlying anti-Greek polemic going on from those other arguments about some Greek ideas over to here. I want you to see the material that unfolds in this section before I go back to that idea to say how much this might parallel some of what looks or could have looked like a Greek symposium. All right, so we got that on the table, though. Coming back around this way. So they're talking about Yaakov Omet, and he says, what do you do with the fact that Pshat Torah says in three verses in chapter 50, he was eulogized, he was embalmed, he was put into the Machpelah, he was buried. Okay, Amar Leh, Rabbi Yitzchak replies to Rav Nachman, Mikra Nidoresh, I'm expounding the verse, Va'ata lo tira avdi Yaakov num Hashem. As it stated, and fear not, my servant Yaakov, says Hashem, Ba'al Techa Yisrael, and do not become broken Yisrael upon his death. In other words, I'm going to help you through this, because even though your father Yaakov has died, Ki hineni moshiacha merachok, I will deliver you from afar, Ve'et zaracha me'eretz shivyam, and your progeny and seed from a distant land. I will deliver. One day you will experience captivity, but don't worry, children. You will still feel connected to your father Yaakov and his land of Israel where he is buried. Makish hu lezaro. Indeed, the verse draws a parallel, what's called a hekesh, between Jacob and his seed. Ma zaro b'chaim, just as the seed of Jacob referred to in the verse, are living and continue to thrive. Af hu b'chaim, so too the legacy of Jacob will be living forever. That's a beautiful sentiment that the Gemara creates here. I'm not talking about having to read such a pasuk or such a lesson of Rabbi Yochanan as total pashat. He's not alive. Od Avinu Chai means that we, the children of Jacob,
Israel is alive,
and thusly the legacy of our father Jacob is alive.
Here, like a couple of weeks ago when you talked about the inconsistency in using the name Jacob and using the name Israel.
Yes.
Here, this seems to be a lot of conflation here, going back and forth between Israel the people, Israel the person, Jacob the person.
Jacob the people, too.
Yeah, and yeah. It really does go back and forth. It's a nice point because Baal Techa Yisrael, but it uses the name for the children, which is a really beautiful way of bringing that out. It's double entendre. Now that you pointed it out, it's really don't despair Yisrael, though your life has come to an end. Don't despair Yisrael, the continuation of the people through the generations. And that could be an answer to the kind of despair that I felt that Shmuel was also expressing, which gets into a connection, Jay, back to the passage before. An important point. You want to see, now watch where it turns, by the way, after such a beautiful limud. Another dialogue between Rabbi Yitzchak and Rav Nachman comes on the scene. Amar Rabbi Yitzchak, Kol Omer Rachav Rachav Miyad Nikre. Anyone who says Rachav Rachav will immediately emit a seminal discharge. Amar Le Rav Nachman. Rav Nachman says to Rav Yitzchak, Ana Amina Veloich Patli. I say it, and I'm not concerned that anything happened. Amar Le, he says, Ki Ka Amina Veyoda Umakira. I'm speaking of only those who know her and are familiar with her. This prostitute from the days of Joshua, who helped save them, remember, Rachav, up there on the walls, who with the two of them were going to, the scarlet, and was going to help the two spies get back to the camp, right? And she was going to be the only one saved from that battle of Jericho. Well, she, in the tradition, is a very special person, and I brought, where is it? No, not a photograph.
The centerfold of the Babylonian.
Oh, Megillah is with Tanit in this volume. Okay, 15a. I just want to give you the sense. In Megillah 15a, Rachav is a well-known figure, and it seems to really judge her very favorably, despite the fact that it was Radak, by the way, Rabbi David Kimchi, who said over there that, you know, she really was a prostitute. No, Rashi, you don't have to kind of cover things up. Because Rashi calls her a pundakita. And Rashi, that word means she was an innkeeper. And she ran an inn.
It was traditional.
Radak says, okay, you could even say it was an inn. But let's not mince words here. She was a prostitute. She was maybe the matron of the whole place. Okay. That is to say, though, that we are open to shavim. We are open to people who make tshuva. We are open to women who are prostitutes, who come around to recognize the power of our God and help save our people. And listen to what they do with Rachav. The sages taught...
Again?
What's that?
You said... Where are you?
I'm in Megillah.
Megillah Tanit.
No.
Okay.
No, Megillah Tanit is a whole different conception.
Yeah. Okay.
Megillah Tanit, we said, was a list of fast days that are possible in the tradition, just to get our terms straight. When I said Megillah, I meant Masechet Megillah, which is a Talmudic tractate. And the Braita about Rachav that we normally would think of in Jewish literacy, hypertext too, is on 15a of Masechet Megillah, and I happen to have it because in this, the Steinfelds, Tanit and Megillah come together.
Okay.
Oh. Tanit and Megillah. But you're, but not in the Hebrew Steinfelds. You're
yeah,
in the Hebrew
Steinfelds. It does.
Oh, it does. Cool. So Masechet Megillah is there. So you could look on. 15a. So it says about Rachav. The sages taught, Tanu Rabbanan, Arba Nashim Yefeifiyot Hayu Ba'olam. There are four women of unbelievable beauty in the world. They were Sarah, Abigail, Rachav Esther. Sarah, Abigail, Rachav, Rachav, and Esther. Ulamanda Amar Esther Yirakroketaita, and according to the one who said Esther was greenish in color. Mapek Esther Ayu Vashti. They said, forget Esther, it was Vashti. Tanu Rabbanan. Rachav Vishma Zinta. Rachav aroused impure thoughts by her name. Boy, did she have a reputation. And then over here, it does say, Amar Rabbi Yitzchak, Tzar Rabbi Yitzchak, Kol Haomer Rachav Rachad, Miad Nikri. Has an immediate seminal omission, if you say Rachav Rachav. Amar Le Rav Nachman says, Ana Amina Rachav Rachav Velo Ichpas. No, I say it doesn't make a difference. Ki kamen abiyodeh v'kam makira. That only is about the people who know her personally. Now, that's because of you. They want so much to give it. So that is what we have. Now, what's really cool is also, though, that Rachav is not only known over there and over here as this person who causes all this, but she's also known as a woman who is the ancestor of prophets. And she becomes, in the tradition, known as one who begets lots of incredible personalities in Israel. Now, as you know, we're also looking at this volume by Tali Lan, and this is about manuscript work, and it's about feminist commentary on the Gemara. So you can imagine there's a little to say over here about this page, right? And so here we are at the feast, and it says, in the long line of traditions cited in Bavli Ta'anit 5a-b by Rabbi Yitzchak in his sessions with Rav Nachman, only the last one is not given in the name of Rabbi Yochanan. So this one's not given in the name of Rabbi Yochanan. Where is Rabbi Yitzchak from? From Israel, close to where Rachav lives. This is an obscene statement about the momentous sexual impact that the thought of the biblical prostitute Rachav has on a man. Just uttering her name brings about arousal and seminal emission. Rav Nachman, in answer, disputes this statement, daring to utter the name so as to prove that nothing happened. However, Rabbi Yitzchak maintains that this is only because Rav Nachman is not among her acquaintances. Since these are the last words on the subject, the truth of Rabbi Yitzchak's utterance is not disputed. Rachav. Now, the tradition about Rachav is purely Babylonian. It has a parallel in Megillah 14b and 15a. Okay? Now, what we didn't go on 14b and see what was said over there. So I just go back to that. 14b... just find the one place I need. Okay. Eight prophets who were also priests, Shmona Nevi'im Vehem Kohanim Yatsu Merachav HaZona. Eight priests descended from Rachav the prostitute. Ve'eluhain. And here they are. Here are their names. Neiria Baruch, Sharia, Mahaseya, Yirmiyahu, Chilkiyah, Hanamel, the Sholem. Not that same Yirmiyahu, not the prophet. These are priests. Neriah, Baruch, Syria, Masiyahu, Jeremiah, his father, Chilkiah, and Jeremiah's cousin, though, that Jeremiah, Hanamel. So, we seem to have on 14b a very positive statement, but then 15b, Rabbi Yitzchak comes along. But overall, what the scholars are going to show you, that this is only a Babylonian tradition. Rabbi Yitzchak from Israel is really in the Babylonian Talmud, though we say he's from Israel. In other words, it's not in the Yerushalmi. It's not in the Talmud, the Jerusalem Talmud. This composition in Bavli Megillah and in Bavli Tani both have the same learning, but in Megillah it begins positively. Quoting a Tanaitic tradition, it maintains that the offspring of Rahab include priestly prophets and are very well connected, as if we have a very deep understanding that even prostitutes can redeem themselves and provide for the goodness of the entire Jewish people. As opposed to the tradition of the land of Israel as presented, in which Rahab is viewed as creating seminal omission and sexual desire, she is presented in the Bavli, first and foremost in Megillah, as presenting positive, potential prophetic light. What do we think is happening? I think we may assign this to a very mild polemic against the Christian literary motif of the repentant prostitute. That the later Talmud Bavli sees a deep connection to the Rahab story, or the positive trope of the Rahab story, with Mary Magdalene, which early Christianity told. The motif of the repentant prostitute became common, and it was up to the rabbis to deny it. These were probably chosen in terms of the traditions at all, and I would add because of the death, life and death motifs that aren't necessarily going to be called out in this paragraph here, but that it's deeply philosophical, right? About life and death itself, about who's got that power, about how much power, about how nature and natural law is related to the ongoing notions of history, diachronic history as it unfolds. That these protagonists in our narrative series of teachings, Rabbi Yitzchak, Rabbi Nachman, Rabbi Yochanan, both representing Israel and Babylonia, the entirety of the Jewish people at the time, that they are paralleling in that they are at a feast, a Greek symposium. The similarities to that are striking. The feast in the Bavli is gendered, and people are learning, meaning men are learning, paralleling the Greek symposium. The same is true for the Greek symposium. The rabbis begin by feasting and probably also drinking. Then they engage in words of wisdom, which in this particular midrash is pointed out, batar sa'od, after they eat. This also happens in the Greek symposium, where they wait until after the meal. I insert, unlike the kind of culture that the rabbis created themselves already, and that we would have imagined, we knew that you could speak words of Torah within and among all courses of the meal. Philosophy is discussed. What of the Rahab story? They end with obscenities, licentiousness. The symposium had a tradition of inviting prostitutes into the symposium at the final stages. And the rabbis, at least Rabbi Yitzchak, warned against even saying the names. Don't say Rahab, Rahab, gentlemen. Don't say it.
We also have Tamar tradition as well. Where she's certainly not, she's not a professional prostitute, if you will, but certainly she functions as a prostitute in that story.
Oh, yes.
And she's not someone who's thought of badly, I don't believe.
No, not even not believe. She actually puts Judah onto the path of tshuva.
Right.
Sadkami many. She was known as the righteous, though she is considered prostitute, if you will. And there again is very, very good parallel, positive notion of what a woman in that capacity can bring to the table by way of Jewish learning, potential for tshuva, and potential prophetic notions surviving our people into the future. Wonderful to be in the Beit Midrash together to learn. I just want to, housekeeping, if there's another question I'll take in a second. We are through the month of December, right? Because what's the date already?
The
19th. So we do not have a session next week. We do not have a session the first week of January. We will get together the second week.
At the week of the 7th?
Yes. Rabbi Wexler will, it'll come out in the newsletter, will be teaching twice during the month of January on two Wednesdays, and that will be a two-time series called Existence and Place. And so he will be blessing us with 2 weeks of teaching on Wednesday nights, and then we'll figure out schedule from there in terms of ongoing learning. I mean, just, yes. Yes, they're all recorded. And yes, it's an ongoing learning kind of thing, but I may have 1 week that I'm not here on a Wednesday, and I'll just let you know when that is, but I'm not sure yet when that is. But great to be back together before the couple-week break we're going to take. Yishar koach. Did you have some other...
Just a comment that the tradition of what men say when they're alone, as in the famous tape, goes back a long way.
That's right. Very good.
Thank you.
I haven't had the last word tonight. Let it be noticed.